I went to Augusta, to the Georgia State Prepaid Convention 2.5 years ago. And I don't know, I had about 6 months, I guess. And we had been to the Roundup and had so much fun at the Roundup, we wanted to go to the convention. We went down there, and it was a little different because we didn't know anybody. You're in a hotel with 2,000 people, and everybody's walking around, and just kind of felt lost. And I don't know how we met Paul and his wife, Cody, and introduced ourselves, and they were from Atlanta, and so I guess we felt a little comfortable there, just like felt like we knew somebody. And Paul gave a talk Sunday morning, and it was a really good talk, and I really enjoyed it, as well as the other 2,000 people that were there. And listened to his tape, and I've shared his tape with many people in this room. And when it came time to have the anniversary, I thought that we'd like to have Paul come and speak. And I think a lot of people said, well, he's not going to come and speak here. I said, well, let me ask. And so I called, and he said he would, and I was nervous. I think I called him last night a little bit late, just to make sure that we were both on the same calendar date. And anyway, I hung up, and I said, I think I woke him up. She and my wife, Donna, said, I told you not to call him so late, but just like an alcoholic, to put it off till the last minute. So like I said, Paul is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's been sober a long time, and I know that he has worked with many people in this program. In fact, he's been with many meetings with people in this room. There's a lot of people in this room that when I walked in these doors and came to these meetings, Jim and Carol and John and many, many people in this room. And you all been here long before I have, and you all been to meetings together, and it's just really like one big family. And I'd like us to give a nice warm welcome to Paul E., Lilburn Third Tradition. Thank you very much for coming and speaking.
Thank you, Dan. My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. Dan, talking about a lot of people in this room knew me. The couple of folks mentioned beforehand that they could tell my story, and Jim said he could tell my story better than I could. What is my story? You know, I got drunk, I got sober, and now I'm living happily ever after. Isn't that what we're supposed to say, or how we're supposed to say it? Last night when Dan called me, and it wasn't that late, it was what? 11:45, something like that, 12:30. And we talked a few minutes on the phone, and I wasn't really into talking on the phone right then, but Dan wanted to mention how he wanted me to do this program tonight. Something about, you know, I said, well, everybody's heard my story around Atlanta. I mean, you tell it, and nothing... There's a lot of things changed. Like the other day, I went to a meeting during the rain. I stopped in over at one of the day meetings at one of the club rooms, and I sat in there and listened to everybody tell the same story that I told the first time I came in and the first few months. And you know, everybody came to a meeting that day because it was a rainy day and they might get drunk. And the thing about the time I was sitting at NABA, and a guy was in there, and he had just been on a drunk, and he came back, and everybody was questioning him about this deal. You know, how many meetings did you go to? And the thought hit me, well, how many meetings did he need to go to stay sober? If he went to 7 and he got drunk, he needed to go to 8. If he went to 10 and he got drunk, he needed to go to 11. And it also turned around, and I realized that, you know, sometimes we ourselves don't accept this disease of alcoholism. We think that by physical actions that we can stay sober. If I go to enough meetings and talk to my sponsor enough and read enough of that literature over there, I'm going to stay sober. And what happens if I get drunk? Then that means I didn't go to enough meetings, I didn't study enough of that, and I didn't spend enough time talking. Is that really what keeps you sober? See, this is what Dan was telling me this morning at 12:30 when he called me. He said, listen, Paul, what I want you to do is get up and sort of pontificate upon the nuances of our vernacular. Elevate us to intellectual and philosophical planes of spiritual enlightenment. And I said, whoa. I said, I'm glad you called me early enough that I can get this together to do this. So when we talk about telling our story, you know, the bottom paragraph, to the forward to the third edition, in our book called Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, regardless of the great increase in size and span of our fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. You know, that's what we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe we use different kind of words or different attitudes and all, but we talk about recovery. That's what we share. And I often think about sitting in a meeting and saying, well, you know, I'm glad I'm at a meeting today because being at a meeting today will guarantee that I won't get drunk. Is that recovery? Is that the reason I come here? Is that the reason I sit in these meeting rooms? And I was thinking about it while we were, while Jim was doing the history of the thing, and, you know, I've sat in some of them smoking meetings. I remember one time at the Atlanta Roundup, there was so much smoke in the room, it sort of just, we had to do like that to keep it from just enveloping all of us, and they don't smoke at the Atlanta Roundup anymore as a result of that. I think not only our people, but everybody in that motel sort of was tired of the smoke. And I thought it was interesting how groups start because of that. You know, I remember one time there was a group started, and they called themselves the 60-minute group because somebody got mad because the meeting went to 9:05. It didn't cut off at 9 o'clock. And when we talk about those things like that, it's good that those things happen. I mean, this third tradition group, I've been here, I've enjoyed the meetings I've had here. There's a lot of people in this room that I know and I've been to meetings with. Matter of fact, I had my anonymity broken tonight. I'm sitting over there with my wife, and John O. came over and kissed me. And he promised he'd never do that in front of my wife. And now I got to explain that on the way home. You know, it'd have been, I've done, you know, I can do a lot of explaining about other things, but that's going to be a difficult one. Thank you, John. When we tell our story, what is our story? Yeah, we got drunk, we got sober, and we lived happily ever after. In my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I look back over the years, like this afternoon, we celebrated our son's 23rd birthday, which he had this past Monday. Our son Ryan's never seen me drunk. He's seen me crazy and insane like a sober drunk will be. And so there's been the 25 years, so one day at a time, I walked with the fellowship, walked with the program, did the things I was supposed to do, a lot of things I wasn't supposed to do. Living a thing called sobriety. What does it tell me? That sometimes when we sit there, we forget about the simplicity of what really is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell a story about that, per Dan's request. It seemed there was this young man that was endowed with everything necessary for him to be successful in life by society's standards. He had the intellect and the financial means by which he gained an education. This education afforded him the opportunity to join with a giant corporation. He made his moves within that corporation, climbed the executive ladder, was able to purchase membership in the country club, the fine, beautiful home, the automobiles, the material well-being that measures success. The people in the community looked at this young man and deemed him successful. Well, one day this young man looked at his life and realized there was a void, there was something missing. And he felt to be truly successful, he must have all areas of his life filled, so he attempted to fill this void in his life. In the beginning, because he had the financial means, he tried the psychologist, psychiatrist, group therapy sessions, expended a lot of funds in this endeavor, and it gained him nothing. Some time had passed, and he found himself on the streets with groups of people like him, people that were seeking an answer, and they weren't sure what the question was. One morning, this young man came to in an alley, and he was thinking about his life, and looked back on it, and this quest he was on to fill this void in his life, and he recalled that when he was acquiring his education, he had been given a great set of books. And this great set of books introduced him to the philosophers of the past and the philosophers of our time. And he said, if I return to those books, I will find my answer. So he began to study those philosophies. And intellectually, he was able to understand what they shared with him. But he could not apply it in his life. But in this great set of books, there was a study of the religions of the world. And he read about in one of our Far Eastern religions about a group of men that were referred to as gurus. And what he read about these gurus, that they had all answers, all knowledge, and all understanding of life. The young man said, that's what I need. I need a guru in my life. So he boarded an airplane that landed in New Delhi, got on a boat that went down a river. At a bend in the river, the boat docked. The young man disembarks with his belongings, and he walks towards his village, and the people in the village approach him. Now, he couldn't understand their language. They can't understand his language. But they had seen many men like him come down this river, and they knew why he was there. So when he posed the question, where is the guru? They pointed toward a mountain. This young man looked towards this mountain, and between him and this mountain was this vast wilderness. He began to have second thoughts about his journey. And then philosophically, he says to himself, well, maybe I have to suffer some more before I find my answers. So he began his trek across that great wilderness. After many weeks of hard journey, he came to the base of that mountain, broken in body, broken in spirit, realizing once again his endeavors would gain him nothing. But as he lay there at the base of that mountain, he looked up, and he noticed there was a curl of smoke coming off a small ledge. And he said, that's where the guru lives. So he climbed that mountain, came to the base of that ledge, and there was a ladder, and he climbed this ladder and stood upon the ledge and looked upon an elderly man that was sitting in a lotus position, meditating upon the setting sun. The young man said, guru, what must I do to find peace, happiness, serenity, and understanding of life? The guru broke from his meditation upon the setting sun, turned and looked to our brother and said, don't drink and go to meetings. So when we talk about simplicity, and I sat in that meeting it was Wednesday morning, and everybody walked into that meeting, and the reason they came that day was so they wouldn't take a drink and wouldn't get drunk. And sometimes that's how simple it becomes. Because regardless of what I do within my life, intellectually, physically, as an alcoholic, I cannot stay away from that first drink of my own power. That's the essence of the first step. Because I tried that. From my first drunk when I was 12 years of age on a small Indian reservation in South Dakota to my last drunk on May the 3rd in 1971. The things that I tried that didn't work for me, all them concepts, whether it was a philosophical approach or a physical approach, the geographical cures, all the things that... And until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and went to that first meeting and got a realization of what it's like. Someone mentioned by my sponsor tonight that Papa Joe, that he's still my sponsor. His first introduction to me and the concepts that he shared with me, I mean, they're so much different than anything I'd ever experienced, because what happened, there was a spirit. And I guess maybe when we go back to those meetings, sit down and actually maybe, I don't physically go to a meeting realizing it's going to keep me sober. I go to a meeting and sit down and I catch the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it's a sharing and a giving and a caring that we're not capable of ourselves of sometime doing out there. I know I want to be a caring person. I want to be a giving person. But a lot of times my motives get in the way and my personality gets in the way. And the only place I can really be truly sharing and giving and caring is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because then this is the place that I have to look and care about somebody else. And we have a lot of fun together. I know we tease each other and poke fun at each other and give each other a hard time after we get familiar with each other. But, you know, this is the place where I really learned it. And how does it happen? And the paradox of what we are. Because let me share with you that first meeting. See, I had my last drunk, or up until that time, I had my last DUI. I ended up in jail, and Tody came and got me out. And I ended up staying with a friend in Decatur, and some things happened, and I ended up back at the house, and during this time that I had been away, Toady had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, Paul, would you like to try Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, I shared with you, I tried different things to get sober, I stay sober, I lead a different life, and I agreed that we would try Alcoholics Anonymous. But see, it wasn't any different than anything else. I tried the church. Matter of fact, I became somebody in that church. You know, I was vice president of the Brotherhood, and I think I was a training union leader. They had a lot of little titles for me. They were trying to help me. It was really a strange thing when I look back on it. I mean, there I was, you know, Toady would try to sober me up Sunday morning so I could get to that church, and we both went in there with a lot of hate and anger towards each other and towards God and everybody else, and yet we were supposed to teach other people how to live, or supposedly that's what we were doing. But anyway, we made that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 25 years of age. I've been drunk for about 13 years. I've been kicked out of the Navy because I was so much of a drunk. And the guy that picked me up, we're driving to the meeting, and he's talking about being drunk for 30 years. And, you know, that was longer than I'd been alive. And I looked at him, and he was so much older than I am. He sort of looked like I do now, I guess. Walked into that meeting room, and it was Sunday night over there in Buckhead, and it was a nice meeting. They didn't have styrofoam cups. They had fancy coffee pots like that, but then they had little china cups. You know, and the people were well-dressed for a... And I didn't dress like that. Mercedes and Buicks and nice cars in the parking lot, and I didn't have a car like that. And all at once it begins to work for me. As I looked around the room, I couldn't find anybody physically that I could identify with. You know, these people don't, I can't dress like them, I can't act like them, I don't drive a car like them. They're so much older than I am. And it might have been the reverse if I came now. See, everybody would be so much younger than I am. But whatever. I could find reasons I don't belong. And I sat down in the front row of that meeting that night, and I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do, and they went through the procedure just like we did here, and then a lady got up and spoke, and she happened to be a school teacher or principal or something in one of the local school systems that requires education. I don't have an education, and another reason I don't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the meeting's over with, and I'm sitting there on the front row. I'm afraid to move. I don't want to do anything wrong. And I hear the people behind me talking, and, you know, they're talking about going on vacation. Now, I had never been on vacation. I've spent a lot of time off from work, but I had never been on a vacation, and here's another little tick mark for I don't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I'm sitting there, there's a hallway in front of me. The door's open, and this little bald-headed, dried-up old man bounces up that hallway. And he walked up and introduced himself to me, and he talked, and I don't know exactly what he said, but what impressed me was this particular, very profound statement that he shared with me. As he turned to walk away, he said, Paul, you stupid little bastard. If you don't drink liquor, you can't get drunk. Now, Toady might have voiced something similar to that in reference to my drinking. There might have been other people that did the same thing. But something happened that particular time. There was something that I'm not even sure about, but a thing came across that, hey, this guy really knows about me. See, because up until that time, I was a unique individual. I was the only one in the world that really had time periods in my life that I couldn't recall, and I'd been and doing things because the reason I knew I'd been doing things is because the police had a record of it. This is what you did from the time we picked you up at 12 o'clock until 7 o'clock this morning, and all these scars and this blood on you, this is the reason they're there. I knew I was doing things, but I couldn't recall them. I was the only person in the world that, you know, had a real good week. They entrusted me with a little responsibility on the job. As a matter of fact, they even let me drive one of the cars home. That particular time, I got a Christmas bonus and a decent paycheck because I'd worked all week. And and I was going to go home, and Toadie and I were going to celebrate Christmas together, and everything was looking great, and here comes an old buddy of mine from the very near past, and he said, let's have a beer, and, you know, 2 days later, I don't know where the car is, I don't know where my money is. I was the only person in the world that was like that. People didn't understand me. And so when people talk to me about, you know, why don't you change your life, Paul? Why don't you do this, or why don't you do that? Why don't you go to church? Why don't you join a civic club? Why don't you become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Why don't you lead a Boy Scout troop? Why don't you do all these things? It won't work for me because I'm different. I'm unique. There's only one person in the world like me. I'm crazy. I'm insane. There's something wrong with me. I'm not like other people. And when I talk about somebody knowing me, this is what I'm talking about. You know, this is what we have as sober, recovering members of Alcoholics Anonymous that we can share, the experience, strength, and hope. Sometimes we forget that loneliness and that utter fear that we had up there, that we cover up with so many masks and so much of a facade that we're okay in the world. And I think about it when they say, carry a message to the alcoholic who still suffers. How many people in these meeting rooms are still that way? That we put that mask on and that facade and I'm okay. And yet inside I'm still dying because I'm so much different than everybody else. I don't really belong. I'll just go through the physical motions and it'll be okay. The spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what we share. Some of us have the ability to use the words and tell the stories. Some of us come and make the coffee and set up the tables. Some of us are able to use the telephone. Some of us are able to drive. All of us become a part of the whole and we all belong to each other. We all take care of each other. We all share and give to each other. And that's what I felt through this little bald-headed, dried-up old man and the way that he approached me. And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the introduction to the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went 7 months. And I went through the physical motions that we go through. I went to a meeting every night. I listened to some great speakers. I found out that when the speaker was real good, that people liked him more. And I said, maybe I could do that. I found out that if I read the book and that literature over there, and at this right time just sort of popped little things into place, people thought you were spiritual or something and patted you on the back, told you how good you were doing. So I studied that. And at the right time, in the right place, with the right group of people, I became a part of something. May 3rd, 1971, it's Monday afternoon. I'm finishing some work over here in Clarkston, and there's a guy that I work with. His name is Mike. Mike, he likes his booze and he likes his pills, and him and I are sitting there waiting for this equipment to be loaded on these trucks so we can finish up our job. And he says to me, Paul, he says, what is it you have? You seem to have a lot of friends. You laugh a lot. You've got a good job here and they pay you well. What is it you have? And here it is, this great opportunity to share with him this concept they have of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what did I have to share with him? I have to share with him that I have a relationship with a group of people called Alcoholics Anonymous. We go to meetings every night. We have birthdays and people celebrate, and we ate cake, and we drink a lot of coffee, and we go to the Waffle House afterwards. That's the only thing I could share with him, because, see, that's all that I had been doing. I learned some words in the right time to say them, the right place to say them. So, I said, Mike, would you like to go with me? And he said, sure. Monday evening, we're driving home. We're going to my home group that night. As a matter of fact, they were having a birthday for a couple of the guys in the group. And going down the road, Mike says, Paul, do you mind if I stop and get a beer? And here I am, this great member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have empathy with the suffering that he's going through. And I said, sure, you know, so we pull in that first pack of straws. See, that's how little I know. When we talk about simplicity, you cannot stop drinking by continuing drinking. I didn't know that at the time. We slid into that first package store, you know, and he gets out, runs in, jumps back in the closed cab of that truck, and pops that top, and sweat, the aroma. And we stop at the next package store. And I joined him. And I had 7 months without a drink. 7 months doing all the right things at the right time in the right place. At certain times, we're going to have no effective mental defense against the first drink, and no human power is going to be capable of keeping us from that first drink. That's when we have to call on a power greater than ourselves. See, I'm driving down the road, and I got Mike sitting next to me. We're going to my home group that night, and I began to think about what I was to become in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, they enjoy the speakers that can get up and say the right words and all the proper phrases, and I was working on that. I practiced real hard. I learned to memorize certain things out of the book, to say them at the right time. And now I'm saving souls. I got my first real-life pigeon here next to me. I'm going to become somebody. That was my thought process. The farthest thing from my mind was taking a drink. I cannot afford to take a drink. This is what I want to do. This is the most important thing in my life, is to get this guy to a meeting, not for his benefit, but for mine. And we stopped at that package store, that second one, and I had my last drunk. Mike didn't have his last drunk until about 4 months later. He got killed in a knife fight on North Druid Hills Road. So through my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have those things to look back on. That little bald-headed, dried-up old man who walked up to me and said, "You stupid little bastard, if you don't drink liquor, you can't get drunk." I got this guy named Mike that's riding with me to an AA meeting. And I made it, and he didn't. What is this thing that we really have here? At certain times, we're going to have no effective mental defense. You know, is it all the physical things that I do? Is it all the knowledge that I have? Is it how much literature I read? Is it how many times that I do what I'm supposed to do? And so I guess when I share with you my story, I just within this time frame, that I'm going to try to finish up by 9 o'clock, so we won't have another 60-minute meeting starting in Lilburn. To share about Alcoholics Anonymous from that last drunk up until today, you know, that's longer than I drank, longer than I've been alive before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the things that happened to me, and to simplify them, just to put them in a consensus of what has it really given me. And one of the words that we use in Alcoholics Anonymous that sometimes we talk about, and it took me a long time to understand it, and that word was freedom. You know, there was a time past that I could talk about and share freedom from the obsession or the compulsion to take a drink. It wasn't always a daily, constant battling. And maybe that even made it more difficult for us that didn't drink every day or weren't drunk constantly. You know, sometimes it would sneak up on us. You know, like sometimes I'd walk by a bar and then that aroma would come out, the stale smoke and the stale beer and all of that. And there was an attraction to that in my mind. And I'd have to walk to my meeting, went by a place called Moe's and Joe's down there in Highland Avenue, and every once in a while that little whiff of smoke would come out and grab me and try to pull me in. Not all the time, not every time I walked by there. So mine wasn't a constant daily battle with this compulsion to take a drink or thinking it would ease the pain or whatever reason or excuse I wanted to use to walk in that place and order a beer. So there was that freedom from that when I could comfortably go in a place where they were drinking alcohol and it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, I think I made it a big deal. You know, the first time, hey, I conquered it. I am on top of the mountain now. There was that freedom. And then the freedom from the fear and the loneliness. And I think that took longer than the compulsion, the obsession to stay away from that first drink. And then the freedom of trust. You know, Tody began to trust because of the way that I acted and what I did. And freedom to be myself. So when we use the word freedom, it depends upon where we're at the time. And what I really found out was that the true freedom is, in a sense, to be myself, to be who I am. Like Papa Joe shared with me one time, he said, you know, the only thing you got to do is die. And acceptance of that attitude is I found the true freedom, that I can be myself. I don't have to do anything anymore. I don't have to read all that literature for your benefit. I read it for mine. I don't have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to stay away from that first drink. I go there because I enjoy being there, even if the same stories are told over and over and over again. Because I enjoy being with that spirit, that part of it. And fortunately, I've been to meetings all over the country. Not as a speaker, but traveling to my job, I walk into meeting rooms, and I had a real good feeling in a meeting one night. I walked in there, and of course, I guess the way that I look like a newcomer anyway, but I went in and I sat down, you know, I got the coffee, and I sat down and said hello to somebody next to me and whatever, and they went through their procedure. And I had a real good feeling after the meeting, because what they did was they took one of their little meeting cards, and there was space on it for phone numbers, and everybody put their number. And I thought maybe it was, you know, some of that probation stuff, and they were having to sign up. And they didn't pass it to me. They just sort of slid it by me. And after the meeting, they gave me that card. I mean, that's what it was for. That this is what they did for all the newcomers in that particular group. And that felt good. Of course, you know, my ego got in the way, and I wanted to tell them, hey, wait a minute, you know, I know all about this stuff. Yeah. You know, I helped invent Alcoholics Anonymous. But the freedom to be myself, to walk in there and sit down and not have to be necessary that I... Let me tell you how Alcoholics Anonymous works. This is the way we're supposed to do it. But just walk in and sit down, and there was that good feeling. That's the spirit that I talk about, that I share, to just be who I am. So how does being who I am work? I was a year sober in a home group. My home group was the Northeast group. It had 8 members in it. Myself and another guy and 6 little women. There was a lady in there named Neely. Neely, when I got here, had been sober 25 years. These were my grandmothers, and they took care of me. Papa Joe said they spoiled me, they were going to kill me because they were taking too good a care of me. And we had my first birthday, and we got a big out-of-town speaker. I think he came from Jefferson. And one of them baked me a special cake, just my special cake for me. And we put balloons up and little flyers and things, and everybody came, and this guy from Jefferson told his story, and people talked about how great I was doing and all of this stuff, and I got up and took my chip, and everybody hugged and kissed me, and it was great. That first birthday, it was really something. And I slide back over to the corner of the room, and there's Papa Joe standing there leaning up against the wall. And I extend my hand for Papa Joe to tell me, kid, you've done great. I was preparing a speech for him. Tell me how good I was or something. And as I extend my hand, he looked at me and said, bastard, don't think you're somebody. And he walked out the door. That was a Monday night. On Tuesday night, on Wednesday night, my job was to go up and set up the tables and all for the discussion meeting. And I got down there and I set out the tables and made the coffee, and I was doing all the things that I was supposed to be doing. And Neely comes in about 20 minutes after 7. She sits down at one of the tables there, and I got all my chores done, and I got her a cup of coffee, and she explained to me, she said, well, Paul, I had been out shopping, and I want to drive home and drive all the way back to the meeting and all. It took me a long time to realize that Neely stopped in for me that night. But as we sat down there, and she began to talk to me, and she said, Paul, when I got sober in 1946, you know, we didn't do all the things we do now. We didn't have birthday parties and give cards and all of those things that we do now. She said, we kind of felt we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. How fortunate can we be that we have people that care enough about us to tell us the truth? Bastard, don't think you're somebody. We kind of felt we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. In my time in Alcoholics, my journey to find who I am and be myself, I've had those kind of people that shared with me this, that cared enough about me to tell me the truth. And because enough people cared about me to tell me the truth, I became what I am. And I tell a story about our son Ryan, who celebrated his 23rd birthday, in this concept of being who you are. When Ryan was a senior in high school, matter of fact, when he was a junior in high school, they began to recruit him. We began to get letters from different colleges and universities. And Ryan was a soccer player, Stone Mountain High School. And he did all right with his grades and did with his other things. And during this time period, Tody and I were invited to come up to Notre Dame and spend a weekend up there and look around at the university. And we went up there and almost making a trip back to Minnesota, and we stopped in there and took advantage of a tour of the University of Notre Dame. And the person that was talking to us was showing us all his things and showed us this Notre Dame banner room with all these things around the wall. And they said, when Ryan walks out of this school with his degree from Notre Dame, he can go anywhere. And we thought it was great, the prestige of that school, the tradition of that school. And then they told us, you know, that I said, well, you know, I'd like to meet your soccer coach and talk with him a little bit. And they said, well, he's not available right now. And we talked a little more. And finally they said, well, we don't want Ryan to come and play soccer for Notre Dame. What we do want Ryan to do is help us fulfill our minority quotas. We want Ryan because he's an American Indian. And so we came home, and Ryan went back up there for a week that fall, and they treated him royally, gave him a room in one of the dormitories, had six guys assigned to him that week to spend time with him, taking him to classes and showing him around the campus, taking him to parties and all the things they do in their recruiting programs. Got him a seat to the USC Notre Dame game. So Tody and I went to pick Ryan up, and we're coming home, and he's telling us how great it was, the tradition in being in that, under that golden dome and watching Notre Dame beat USC and all those things. And when we get home and we sit down and talk about it, I said, what do you think, son? He said, Dad, let me ask you something. He said, do they want me out of Notre Dame because I'm a soccer player or because I'm an Indian? And I told him. And he said, I don't want to go. He said, I want to be a soccer player. Now, soccer players, you know, how much money do they make? He plays soccer for a little amateur team now. They got to go out and find sponsors to help pay their entry fees to tournaments. They got to pay for their own uniforms. They got to buy their own shoes. They got to contribute to help pay the referees for the games. Ryan turned down an opportunity to get a degree from university that any place in the world he went, he would have been walked in, and he would have already been three notches up the ladder. But because of this thing that we be who we are, I talk about it. See, we can get up right here, stand up and be whatever we want to be, do anything we want to do, as long as we're willing to pay the price. And surprisingly, before I found out about who I am, everything that had was a price that I put on something in life was materialistic. How much salary I made, what kind of vehicle I drove. Remember when I walked into that first meeting, that's how I judged how the people were dressed, how they conducted themselves, what their status was within the community. And I learned that true freedom comes from, I can just be me. If I practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous as I learn them in the 12 steps, that I share, that I give, that I care about other people. Not just in the meeting rooms, but everywhere. I have true freedom. And I taught my son that. But really, I didn't teach him that. We taught him that. Because he used to come to these meetings with me, like some of those little kids I sat down there with their coloring books. Because, see, what we have here is this spirit that we share with everyone. This spirit that is Alcoholics Anonymous. And we can talk about it, we can dissect it, we can put it in words that we read before the meeting and after the meeting and out in the parking lot, and we can listen to the tapes going home and coming to, and we can do all those things, but you know, that spirit is something we can never really describe or find or see. We experience, but we never, when it really hits us, I can never describe it. Because how did I make it to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Paul, would you like to go to church? Sure, I'd like to go to church. I just want everybody to get up and back and leave me alone. Paul, would you like to join the Boy Scouts? Yeah, I'll join the Boy Scouts. Would you like to join Alcoholics Anonymous? Yeah, I'll go to an AA meeting. Whatever. How was it that the point of time came for me to walk to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? What happened? There was something there. There was a spirit moving in my life and moving in other people's lives. And all at once, this man picks me up and takes me to a meeting. I meet this little bald-headed, dried-up old man and countless others that shared with me the truth. Maybe I wasn't receptive to it. Maybe I closed my mind and my heart to it. But regardless of how strong I fought it, it still came to me. So when I talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, I got drunk. And because of my drunkenness, I got kicked out of school. I've only completed the 8th grade. I got kicked out of the Navy because I was so much of a drunk. Matter of fact, John went with me as we sat before the Naval Review Board in 1975. John Holmes back there, and I appreciate him taking me up there and listening to my service record and talked about some of the silly, crazy things I did. And I was able to change that less than honorable to an honorable discharge. All those things that happened to me that as a result of being a drunk for 13 years on the reservation out here in the streets of Atlanta, the arrest record. And since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't been in jail. I've got a lot of speeding tickets. I haven't been to jail. I haven't been kicked out of many places. And so what was the change? Was the change because I stopped drinking? No, but because I sat at a meeting and heard a guy in complete violence and anger talk about his time here, you know, 6 years he spent. And so I share that maybe that's not what it is, but I will share with this one story about maybe we can never really describe it, but it happens to all of us. If it hasn't happened yet, it will. One day at a time, we follow that little man that went up that mountain to see the guru. If we don't drink and go to meetings, it'll happen to us. And maybe it's already happened and you don't want to accept it. But it seemed that during the Second World War, there was a small village in Germany that the Allied bombers would make runs over on the way to the industrial plants along the Ruhr Valley, and every once in a while they'd make a mistake and drop bombs on this small village. At the end of the war, they looked and this small village had been completely destroyed. The war was over and the people returned to the village and began to rebuild their lives and try to rebuild their village. And as the people in the village gathered around, they talked about the one thing that had been most important to them, and that was this small cathedral they had in that village. So they asked the priest, could we rebuild our cathedral? And the priest shared with them, well, it'll take a lot of money. You know, it'd take a lot of time. I don't know if we can rebuild it. But first off, we have to have enough money to hire a contractor and an architect. And so the people began to sacrifice. And as they sold their livestock and their produce and their harvest and saved whatever they could and brought the money to the priest, and they began to accumulate, and finally they accumulated enough money to hire an architect and a contractor. And what each person in the village did contribute was in a sense of what they remember about the cathedral, the stairways and the entrance and the altar. But what all of them agreed about was that there was one thing in that cathedral that was most important to them. And that was three stained glass windows. So as they began this reconstruction of the cathedral, The contractor sent out notices that he wanted some stained glass artisans. He was able to hire two immediately, and they began to work on two of the stained glass windows. The contractor looks at it, and here's a hole over here where that third window goes, and he can't find a stained glass artisan to do that job. And as he's sitting in his office one day going over the things and checking out some reports, and this gentleman walks in that's not very well dressed and doesn't really look like he belongs. And he told the contractor, he said, "I hear you're looking for a stained glass artisan." And the contractor said, "Yes, I am. Do you know where I can find one?" And the gentleman said, "I'm a stained glass artisan." The contractor looked at him, and he was expecting a different aura, a different type of personality. And the gentleman said, I realize you don't believe that I'm a stained glass artisan, that I can do the job that I tell you I can do. But I know that you're in trouble. You're behind schedule, and you have a window that needs to be done. I can do that window for you." The contractor began to think about it and says, "Yes, I'm behind schedule. I have nobody else that it's applied to do that window, to sort of bail myself out. Maybe I can use this man." And so the contractor agreed, "I will let you do that third window." The stained glass artisan said, "I have one concession about doing this third window. It must be shrouded. You can't see my work until it is complete." The contractor thought, well, he's a little strange, but I'll do it. So he agreed to that. And so they began to work on the third window, and it was covered. And you can see them each morning as the stained glass artisans arrived to work, and this third one would come by and talk to the other two, and then he'd go in behind his shrouded area and begin working, and the contractor could hear him back there, the chipping and the noise that he would make. And finally the day came when the cathedral was finished, and they brought the people in the village there, and the priest opened the doors to the cathedral, and the people could look and see the completed project. And as they walked around, and the contractor and the architect were pointing out things to them, and the people in the village agreed, "Yes, that's the way it was. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's just the way we remember it." And they walked by, and they walked by that first stained glass window, and they all looked at it and said, "Yes, that's the way it was. That's beautiful." And walked to the second stained glass window and looked at it, and the shroud was still around the third window. And the contractor was concerned about, you know, I'm going to disappoint the people and the priest. I've grown to love these people and care about them and try to do the best job for them. I hope I haven't failed them. And about that time, the artisan steps from behind the shroud and says, "I'm finished." And the contractor wants to take a peek. What is back there? I haven't really ever seen anything. I don't know what kind of job this guy did. But he couldn't do it without the other people, the people in the village. So he just opened the shroud, and there was a presence of light that shone through that window. The people couldn't even speak. They were awestruck by the beauty. And the contractor turned to the stained glass artist and he said, "Where did you get the glass that you did this window with? It's got such presence of light. There's so much beauty in it that we don't have any other glass." And the stained glass artisan said, "Well, what I did each morning is I walked by and greeted my two other artisans and talked with them a few moments. What I would do is reach down and pick up the broken pieces of glass that they had left from the day before. And what they had thrown to the ground as broken pieces of glass are what I've made this window with." Well, we find in Alcoholics Anonymous is a spirit that will take the broken pieces of our lives and put them back together in a way that is more beautiful than anything we could have ever imagined. When we accept that and live that life, we have freedom. Thank you.